change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, thank you for joining us. This is the Nonprofit Snapcast. I am Mickey Desai, your host. Very happy today to be speaking with Ben Munoz. Ben, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, it's Munoz, right?
Munoz. Okay, so in our notes here, I'm reading your bio. You suffered a rare form of stroke called arteriovenous malformation. What is that?
Yeah, so arteriovenous malformation is a rare form of stroke that attacks is maybe the right word.
Sure.
People who are much younger than the typical stroke survivor. So if you ever encounter anybody who had a stroke like myself in their teens or 20s or 30s, it's a very different type of stroke, and it's caused by usually some genetic abnormalities in the blood vessel wall, which causes a rupture. And then, it could take a wide variety of paths depending on the case.
That sounds pretty catastrophic.
Yeah. I think about mortality rates are like 50%. So
right.
It just really depends on so many different variables.
Right. And this experience is what led to you forming Ben's Friends. Is that correct?
Yeah. So initially I had my brain hemorrhage, and then I had brain surgery. Incredibly lucky I survived. And then I had to deal with this entire emotional and physical just trauma of having to rehabilitate surgery. And there was no outlet for me to connect with others. And so I went online. I Googled. There was a mailing list, but there really wasn't anything rich and as supportive as I really needed. So since I have a background as a software engineer, I started a website, and that website became a support group for AVM survivors just like myself. And then a friend of mine from school said, "Wow, this is amazing. You brought together all these people." This was in 2007, before Facebook was a thing and social media had really taken off. And so we were very early. And he said, "This is fantastic. I'm sure there's other patients of other diseases that would appreciate something like this, especially rare disease," because luckily support groups for cancer and support groups for other well-known diseases are out there, and they do a great job. For these rare conditions, they're kind of ignored. There's not much attention paid. And so together we started a second community for a different rare disease, and then a third. And then we incorporated into a 501c3 not-for-profit. And now we have like a whole family of these non-for-profit communities, each of them specific to one rare disease. And that whole family is called Ben's Friends.
That's very cool. Kind of an innovative way to bring folks together that wouldn't otherwise find that kind of support.
Yes, exactly.
So if, you know, do you still... I'm going to use the word segregate, and I'm going to immediately regret it. But do you still segregate by disease process, or is it, have you lumped it all together so that people with different problems can talk to each other? Like if
no,
I had,
we keep them separate.
You do.
Yes.
Okay.
So our thinking is, if I have this disease, it's such an important part of my life that it's so different, and my experiences are so unique, and it makes more sense for them to keep the disease separate, because the experiences are so unique. Like, for example, one community may be an X-linked chromosomal disorder that afflicts young boys. And so their mothers are members of the community, and maybe there's a close to 100% mortality rate. So this is more for about the mothers. And that tone of that community is going to be very different than another community where everybody survives, but they have to live with something either very painful or debilitating.
Right.
And so that tone is going to be very different. And they're going to have a different community name, different logo, different structure. So it made more sense for us to keep them separate from each other.
Sure. I'm sure that each of them has their own unique experience. That makes a ton of sense. But so you said you incorporated and formed a 501c3 around this. Why did you choose to do it as a 501c3 and not just keep it your own private endeavor?
Yeah, we did it for a little while. We had an LLC. It was a non-for-profit, but just because the paperwork was so much easier that we had an LLC. I think you have like a state filing fee in Texas, and that was very nominal. But we thought that it would give us some more, legitimacy, but it would really solidify why we're doing this. And so just having that stamp of approval, this is a 501c3 non-for-profit, made it worth the effort. So right. We could always tell everybody we are a 501c3 non-for-profit, and here's our stamp of approval, as well as donors. We yeah. can encourage donors to make larger donations.
Right, right. So what was the most difficult part of doing that, pivoting from LLC to 501c3?
I'm not an attorney. The mm-hmm. complexity, we had to find I think they're called legal clinics. Yeah. So somebody, and nor did we have the funds to pay for a lot of legal work, but luckily we found a legal clinic, and it was a corporate attorney in Houston, and she helped us file the paperwork, pro bono that we needed. That was a little trickier than I thought. You have to get, the 501c3 non-for-profit, articles and corporations, board meeting and resolutions, and all these things that you you have to do, and just for good civic duty to make sure that all of the paperwork is in order. But it didn't really, it just kind of at the time distracted us from what we really wanted to do, which was fulfill the mission.
Right, right. Too many questions I have in my mind. How do you fund it? Is it all strictly donor funded at this point?
Yeah, it's all donor funded. Friends and family. We have got a couple of small corporate sponsorships, but for the most part, the funding is friends and family. And we have decided to pretty much keep it small and highly impactful. And so we don't really have a large team of people applying for grants and from different foundations and government institutions. It's mostly friends and family. We do an annual GoFundMe, which takes care of half of the budget, and then small fundraisers along the way, which take care of the rest.
Right. So you must keep a very lean shop.
Yeah, that's probably what we're known for outside of like the patient space. We've been written up a couple of times for our attention to efficiency and just low overhead and impact with a small budget.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and my listeners know that I always ask, or at least I think they know that I always ask my guests to give me some bullet points so that we can use that as a loose framework for our conversation. And you wrote something here. There are a couple things here that I wanted to ask you about specifically, but one sentence says, how do you do more with less? So, in that vein of running a lean shop, how are you guys able to do more with less?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a question that we ask all the time. And in fact, I think that's why we've been around since 2007. So yeah, 13, 14 years already. And we've never had large resources, but we survive and we stay lean. And it is because of a mindset that we developed early on, which is always question every expense, always ask, not just like, what are we buying with this? But even go deeper. It's like, what are we buying with this? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a generous gift from a donor. And so we take that seriously. So we have to ask, what are we buying with this? And then further, why do we really need it? Do we really need whatever this specific, like, for example, a software package? Or can we get by with something else and save that money for something that would be more impactful? And so it's just a constant process. And I'm sure that the team gets a little annoyed, always asking why, but they have become accustomed to already having prepared like an argument for why this should be, why should we spend money on this? Yeah. And then not only just asking why, but really questioning even those basic assumptions, like, do we even need to do this? Like, who tells us? Is it an advisor? Does that advisor have more resources than us? How is it going to impact the patient? Is the patient going to really? And sometimes it is. You'll find after all that, you do have to make a big expense, and then you think of it as like an investment.
Yeah.
But it's made intentionally. Like, we know this is an investment, and here's going to be the return. It's not just we hope, because it's not good enough. So that's kind of the main takeaway, is I'll just constantly ask, why do we need this expense, and how will it impact our patients?
Yeah. You made one sentence here, at least one question here. You said, is there a way to get 80% while spending 20%? What does that mean?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many products out there, and there's every salesman of every product or every consultant is going to tell you that you need what they're selling. And it's just understandable. It's their job, and it's your job to try to dissect, okay, what value is this thing providing? Is there a way that I can get most of that with spending nothing, or maybe even a fraction? Because that may be good enough for my needs. Like, I may not need the fastest, most beautiful website out there if no one's really going to care about it. If it's not a showcase that requires it to be that, maybe I can just, you know, maybe I can just hire like my nephew or something to put up a WordPress site or Squarespace site, and it's going to be good enough. Maybe I can get by with all these other things. And then along the way, not only do you have to probably do a little bit more of the work yourself, but you get to learn about whatever it is that you decided to build or cobble together instead of just hire out. So there's multiple benefits from taking the 80-20 approach.
And you guys do a lot of DIY stuff. You don't always farm out everything.
Yes. Yeah. And it is probably the biggest question if you're building a nonprofit or a company, is buy versus build. And if a lot of times it kind of depends on your time horizon. So there are times when we're thinking long term, meaning that we want to invest time into learning and building in-house skills on how to do something. So, like, for example, fundraising. Like, do we want to learn how to approach people for grants, or do we want to dive in and have our own people who we know are committed, who don't have the background, but, and maybe a little bit less successful in the short term, but in the long term, like, wouldn't it be amazing if the person who approached you for a grant, or if you're a foundation and a person who approached you for a grant wasn't a professional grant writer, mm-hmm. but was actually a patient who survived a rare disease and taught herself over a period of months, how to write for grants? Like, that would be much more impactful. So in the short term, easiest thing is probably hire a grant writer. Hourly rate probably can be effective, but in the long term, more effective to learn how to do it yourself and have your own people who really care take on those roles. So that's what we've done repeatedly.
Interesting philosophy. So you're looking at real long-term sustainability in terms of keeping things in-house, keeping your skills close, and maximizing your dollar that way, so that you're not necessarily spending it on someone else's overhead.
Exactly.
It's an interesting thought. So what are some other approaches that you can use to do more with less?
So I think I'm a huge fan of the book called The One Thing by Gary Keller. And there's so many other books along the same line, Essentialism by Greg McKeown, I think. And the premise of all those kind of the books, the philosophy of extreme prioritization, just like constantly asking ourselves, do we need to spend, is this the best use of this dollar right now? We also ask ourselves, is this the best use of this minute right now? So the same approach of time. And then there's going to be one thing that is probably at the top of the list, and it may not be the most urgent, but it is the most impactful. And so it kind of spending time thinking about what is that single most impactful thing that I should be spending my time on right now? And if a consistent use of that mentality means that you actually get so much done instead of, you know, the regular daily, maybe urgent routine work, and then the projects that really move the needle. So yeah. The philosophy of the one thing is something that I talk with our team about all the time, so that we're always working on impactful projects instead of postponing them because they take mental energy.
I suspect that keeping your eye on that long-term horizon is what really facilitates that conversation. Because I imagine that if I were part of a team that not only looked at every dollar, but looked at every minute, that must be a difficult leadership challenge. I mean, you're looking at a nonprofit cause, which is probably already prone to a certain amount of burnout and stress. And now you're trying to, you know, examine, I mean, I know this is something of an exaggeration, right? But now you're trying to examine proper use of time and money. How do you play that leadership game with your staff?
Yeah, so I think it's role modeling is part of it. And after a while, it becomes routine and it becomes a habit. And then you don't have to push anymore, because then those people become your advocates and start proselytizing the rest about this. This is just a better way to get things done. You don't always have to be like looking at your to-do list, how long it is and how much it's just kind of expanding. You as well, let's keep the to-do list very short. It's have all the only high impact things on there. And then if we do that on a consistent basis, we're going to make big strides in the long term.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Got it. Understood. What is sunk cost fallacy and how do you avoid it?
Oh yeah. So, this happens all the time where you've invested time or money in a project. And then unless you question it along the way, you just continue on that project and you finish it out. Right. So part of, again, like goes back to always asking why. So you're halfway through a project. Should you keep on, you should ask, do I continue to invest time and money in this project, or do I stop and use that same time and money in another project? And so constantly asking why, and having the humility to say, oh, I messed up. This is a terrible idea, but that's okay. We all make mistakes. And so we have so many experiments that are going on in our nonprofit where we're testing this project, we're testing this and so many different. And, just constantly reminding the team that it's okay for experiments or projects to fail. That's how we learn. It is not okay to keep on investing time and money in a failed project.
Right. And I guess, of course, you have some sort of operational definition on what a failed project is.
A failed project.
Well, I mean, meaning how do you know what failure is?
Oh, yeah.
Because in my mind, if you're keeping a channel open, I mean, and forgive me if I'm barking up the wrong tree here, but you have different forums for all these very different rare conditions that people may be suffering from. Is a failed project keeping a room open for the only three people in the world who have that problem? Is that a fair way to look at it? Or are you thinking of something else?
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe what's an example? So a specific fundraising campaign, right? We have this campaign and we've never done it before, but let's try it. And we don't know how successful it's going to be, or even if the tactics that we use for marketing it are going to be successful. But it's okay. It's totally okay. It's just an experiment. And we'll track numbers, like we'll track donors, donation open rates, all these like metrics for this specific thing. And if it looks like it's not working, we'll just have the humility to anybody can chime in and say, hey, I don't think this is really working out. Oh, okay. That's okay. Well, we'll go in a different direction and try something else.
Right. Yeah. And I've said that before. Don't fall in love with the strategy. Always be flexible around it.
Yeah.
I love the idea that you're regarding the entire thing as a marathon and not a sprint. I think that's critically important for nonprofits to remember. Yeah. How many people are you serving in an approximate basis?
Uh, I may have the numbers wrong, but this is all public information since we're a nonprofit. But I think our budget is like $75,000 a year, mm-hmm. which is, I think it's, well, there's a lot of nonprofits, but for a nonprofit, I think of our impact, it's a very tiny budget. Sure. Our impact is about 100,000 people a month visit one of our communities or part of our membership base. So 100,000 people a month, all rare diseases, maybe a few thousand dollars, $6,000 a month is kind of a measure of our impact and our overhead.
Ben, that's amazing. My jaw hit the ground when you said that. That's that's fantastic. You're clearly doing very valuable work. If a listener wanted to be in touch with you, how would you suggest they get in touch with you?
Yeah, probably the best way is to contact the leadership team, and you can do that at info@bensfriends.org. You can read more about our mission, how we got started, and the different communities that we serve at www.bensfriends.org.
Fantastic. Ben, again, congratulations and job well done. I wish you continued success, and I have enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for taking the time to do this with me today.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you for publishing these podcasts to help other nonprofits.
To our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode. We invite your support of our efforts via Patreon. Please find us at patreon.com/nonprofitsnapcast. In the meantime, we'll see you with another episode in a few days.
This has been The Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.